This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to a Joycast from Joy 94.9. Visit joy.org.au to find out more about our Joycast.
There is a queer angle to every issue, and we will find it. Don't expect us to be nice. Don't expect it to be safe. And don't expect us to be politically correct. Nothing is sacred. We find the queer, profane, and cringeworthy wherever we can, here on Joy 94.9. Is nothing sacred? There's something
evolving. Hi there, Joysters. You're on Joy 94.9 on Is Nothing Sacred. It's now 2 minutes past ten. We've got a show for you tonight about same-sex parents, or specifically about gay fathers, because hanging around Joy, there are a few gay fathers, so I thought it was a good idea that we actually get a few of them together. So you might even be surprised about some of the voices that you're going to hear. In the studio, there's James, my co-host.
Hello, hello.
And Patrick doing panelling, but he hasn't got a microphone. Hello, Patrick. Wave. Patrick waved, everybody. And also in the studio from Techno Gaze is Michael. Hello, Michael.
Good evening.
And from Bent Notes is David.
Hi, Jim. David.
And sitting next to David is David's son, Matthew. Hello, Matthew.
Hi, how you going?
And so Matthew is going to join in this. He's going to join in this conversation as well. And my daughters, Alice and Sophie, are both claiming that they're sick and therefore they can't come on the show. But anyway, we'll do without them. I'll just tell stories about them rather than let them tell stories about themselves. And Michael doesn't have any of his children here either, so he'll have to tell stories about them as well rather than let them tell their own stories.
I tried to bribe them, but it didn't work.
Right.
Yep.
And we've also got some really good music tonight, I have to say, mainly because I had a hand in choosing it. And
did you want to say something, Patrick?
Patrick always wants to say something. And Patrick's giggling in the other side of the studio, people. And we're going to talk about some of the myths about same-sex parenting tonight, I think, and we'll talk about what people's experiences have been. But if you want to join in this, please give us a call or SMS us on 0427JOY949 or give Robert a call out on the front desk. He is there. Hello, Robert. 1300JOY949, and he will take down anything you want to say and bring it into us, and we might even stick you on air if you're not careful. Or you can actually email us on air at joy.org.au, and we'd love to hear from you. So please do give us a listen. And Nurse James, if you're listening, you're a parent, so you should be contributing to this program as well tonight. So, James, you're not a parent. You're just a child.
No, I'm not. I've just got lots of questions, I guess.
Have you?
A few,
What is your most burning question? Let's start with you and your most burning question.
No, I just think, what would you... I mean, I suppose I'd be an aspiring parent down the line. So, I guess, what would you... As a gay person, what would you bring... What does it bring that's different than any other parent? Or is it all the same? Do you just have the same challenges and fun?
I'll answer that
at the same time.
From my perspective, by talking about my daughter who once was doing an interview with The Age because, you know, she had a gay father and apparently that was really unusual. And at that stage I was being a bit of a gay activist in the Melbourne gay community. And one of the reporters said to her, "What's it like having a gay father, Alice?" And she looked at him and beady eyes, she said, "What's it like having a father?" And that was her response. And I thought it was a pretty good response, really. Well, do you think there's anything different, Michael?
Not really. I think that the challenges that you face are going to be there whether you're gay or straight. And perhaps some of the challenges are a little bit different, but they're still just the challenges. And at the end of the day, it really makes no difference.
David?
I would agree with that, Jim, because if you're a parent, you're responsible for the upbringing of a child into the world, education, introductions to the ways of life in the world, introduction to a whole range of people. that responsibility exists whether you're gay or not. The difference comes when the children are of an age where they know that you might be a bit different to their friends' parents.
Matthew, is he telling a lie or not?
Nah, not really. Don't think so.
Oh, he's telling the truth. Look at that. How well brought up is this child? So, you look like you're burning to say something now, Michael.
No. No, what I was thinking about was that children get embarrassed by their parents. And a lot of time as a parent, you seek out moments when you want to embarrass your children back. And, you know, I found with my children, well, especially my eldest daughter, there was a period of time when she was embarrassed to say that her father was gay. But it's like anything else, you get over it, and sometimes she found it was a plus rather than a minus. Because suddenly people were, you know, thinking that, oh, here's somebody special and somebody different, and it was really a plus in some situations.
So how old were they when they knew that you were gay?
4 and 8.
David? So from...
In my case, what was it, 5 years or so ago, so Matthew would have been 10, my eldest daughter would have been about 16, and the middle daughter a couple of years younger than that. So sort of early to mid-teens.
So it's much different from my experience, because my kids never knew me as straight. I was always gay from the time they grew up, because one was 9 months old and one was 3 and a half when I came out. So they just had a gay parent. And so they used to embarrass me all the time by asking me in front of all their friends, "What's gay, Dad?" Did you ever have that question?
No, I never had that question, because my eldest daughter understood what the concept was. My youngest didn't. But as it is with siblings, you know, the youngest one goes to the eldest one to get to say, oh, what does this mean? And you never hear about it. So it's parenting by proxy, because you raise your eldest child and you say things to them, and your youngest child, they learn everything from their older sibling, and you have no idea what they're being told. Absolutely no idea. And
true.
No control.
You know, I was once asked by one of my kids, the youngest one, who now is a queer filmmaker, and she one day asked me in the car, when one of her friends was in the car, one of her friends from childcare centre was in the car, she said, "What's gay, Dad?" And before I could actually answer, her little friend, Michelle, said, "Oh, Sophie, don't worry about that. You know my mum and Helen." And proceeded to out her mother and her mother's partner in the car. So that was well, job well done, I thought.
Very well done indeed.
Yes. So you don't know what they're being told by other kids or their siblings.
No,
that is true.
You really don't know. And again, this is one of the challenges as a parent, in that you start off life with a brand new baby and you've got all these preconceived ideas, and they go out of the window because you realise it's not true. I felt that I lost control, if you like, as in the ability to influence my children from the age of 2. After 2, they really demonstrated they had their own mind, and no matter what you did, they would do whatever they wanted to do.
And they'd play you off against the grandparents.
Yeah, and everything else. Yeah.
Well, I think the strangest story that I ever had was, and the one that was the most disturbing as a parent, was when one of my children came to me one afternoon. She had a group of her 15-year-old friends there. And she said to me, "Do you know what the best thing about having a gay father is?" And I went, "Nah, what?" And she said, "You don't get molested." And I had to think, oh, so which one of those girls in there has just been telling them that she's been molested by her father?
Mm.
So I had to very discreetly say that, so that, you know, and they all assured me that nothing had happened and they were just having a discussion because of what was in the papers at the time. But I was trying to think, oh, how am I going to go and ring up all the mothers and say, you need to go and have a little talk to your husband? Because imagine that coming from a gay man to a straight parent. They wouldn't have been very well accepted, I don't think.
No, it's a bit of a sad situation, that, isn't it?
It is a sad situation.
You're listening to a Joycast from GLD, TIQ community radio station, Joy 94.9.
Hi there, Joysters. This is Jim, and you're on Is Nothing Sacred on Joy 94.9. It's 10:15 right at the moment. We're in the studio talking about same-sex parenting, and we've got some gay fathers here apart from me. You'll know I'm gay because I was rabbiting on about my... for father, because I'm always rabbiting on about my children. But we've got Michael from Technogaze and David from Bent Notes here. And we've got James at the other end of the studio trying to think up questions to ask us all. Go on, James. Have a go.
Yeah, I do. You've come at a bad time, Jim. I was just thinking about the 60 Minutes interview from last weekend. Do you remember that?
No, I don't. I've never watched 60 Minutes in my life.
I don't know why I was watching
on a commercial TV
station. I go home for family dinners on every Sunday, so it's kind of what's on the TV.
That's because you have straight parents.
I'm sure that any parent could arrange that, gay or straight. But having said that, we were watching it, and it was this big, you could potentially say, confected outrage. Was it the baby that, I won't go into the details, but basically a baby that was adopted overseas. And
you mean the confected outrage without any outrage about all the children locked up in detention?
Yeah. So I guess where it sort of led me was when you have a gay parent, is there potentially, you know, moving forward, we're going to have more and more in the community. Is there going to be a chance where, you know, the media may do a beat up, you know, where could there, I'm just sort of worried in that, and that sort of worried me in that interview where they really tried to make, you know, they wanted to change the laws after it. So it was about adopting, I know that's very, it's a bit different, but obviously that is a quite an option for gay parents about adopting, surrogacy. Those laws are incredibly important, and they also could be quite fickle with, you know, a current affairs programs and the like, on, you know, terrible case bases. What are your views on it?
Well, I think that the majority of gay parents have what might be called natural or unnatural heterosexual conceptions for their children. I certainly did. How about you, boys?
Certainly.
In terms of them growing up?
In terms of them being conceived.
Oh, right. I see what you mean. Yeah. Yes.
So all three of us were actually in relationships with women when our children were conceived. And so, you know, the nonsense about gay people being parents, it's the same with lots of lesbians I know. They were married to men when they had their children. And so it's not about that. It's about the way in which people come to a realisation about their sexuality or decide to be honest about their sexuality. So the whole issue of the confected outrage by the conservative media about gay parents is just confected, and it's a nonsense, really.
Sorry, speaking now, this is Pat here. Speaking particularly about this kind of confected nonsense that does occur in the media about parents who are same-sex attracted, what, in your experience, gentlemen, has been something that has, like, has someone said to you when they found out that you are a parent who is also gay, that has been maybe very misinformed, or certainly you think that's an odd thing to ask, why would it could be because of my sexuality? If it, like, an odd question being a parent, has ever that happened to you guys?
Not to me.
No.
That's
positive to know then. Look, that's really happy to know.
If something was said and maybe it was behind my back, but nothing to my face or nothing that I've ever heard about, no.
And for yourself, David?
No, I've not had anything along those lines, Patrick.
Matthew, do you mind, is there been anything that has been negatively said in terms of if discussing about your father being same-sex attracted?
No, not really. I haven't really told a lot of people, so not a lot of people know except really family.
Yeah.
So there's nothing really been wrong or nothing negative about it.
What about Jim?
Well,
I have a funny feeling there's a story.
No, I've never really had anything negative said to me, and I've always been really out from the time that I had little children, and I used to say to my kids...
We can hear your flames through the radio, Jim.
Can you?
Yeah.
Oh, amazing. You can. And so I used to say to the kids when they were little, you know, it's up to you to tell your friends whether I'm gay or not, but you actually have to think about the fact that their parents mightn't like it and they mightn't let you play with them anymore. And so the kids themselves had the responsibility of self-censorship, and they did it actually quite well. Sometimes they would tell people and sometimes they wouldn't, but they generally got it right, in fact. They'd sometimes say to me, I can't tell so-and-so because their mum won't agree.
And I'd recognise this element of self-censorship because I felt that when it came time for my kids to bring friends home, they were more likely to bring friends home to when they were with their mother than they were with me. And that was because I was in a same-sex relationship and, you know, the mother at the time wasn't. And it was just, it was probably more that it was easier. They didn't have to explain anything if they went to their mother, whereas if they came to me, they would have had to explain, oh, by the way, my dad's gay, this is his partner, and so on. So it was just much easier to avoid the topic and to bring them home when they were with their mother.
Well, mine, I mean, I had a situation where the kids live with me for 2 weeks and then they live with their mother for 2 weeks and then they live with me for 2 weeks. So it was 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off. So there were big groups of time when they were with me. And that was even when I had partners. And so the poor partners then had to be parents, which was quite funny.
Well, that's another challenge in itself, isn't it?
It is a challenge. It's actually getting another gay man to accept the fact that he's going to be a step-parent.
Mm.
In fact, my last partner had to become a step-grandparent.
Right.
And
that's a lot easier than being a step-parent.
But when we split up, my granddaughter said to me, is he still my papa? And I went, do you want him to be? And she said, yep. And I said, well, then yes.
Yeah.
And to his credit, he kept on, you know, he kept in contact with her for a while. Not for a long time, but
yep.
He did keep in contact with her.
You know, I think that there are two challenges here when you come out when you're in a heterosexual relationship, because one, you're dealing with the loss of that relationship or the stopping that relationship, and then the other is you're dealing with finding your own sexuality and seeing how that affects, you know, your children and your immediate family. So there are really two things that are going on, and it can be difficult, I think, when you've got you know, a couple that split up and you've got one that might be happy because, you know, suddenly, you know, you found your sexuality and you're happy and comfortable, whereas your partner has obviously, you know, lost something from this relationship. And then the anger from that, together with the split up, can also fall through onto the children. And so that makes it doubly hard.
That is true. And I think that one of the big problems, I think, for the straight partner in a same-sex relationship, split when there's a split up with one partner being same-sex attracted, is the fact that everybody assumes that they're going to be anti-gay and they're going to be bitter and twisted about the gay partner, which wasn't my experience at all, I have to say, because the mother of my children was entirely positive about my sexuality and was always positive with the children about it and never used it as a weapon
yep.
against me. Even though her family tried to use it as a weapon, she resisted it. And still, we remain friends until this day.
Well, I must say, I consider myself to be equally blessed, in that my ex-wife, you know, obviously there was a period of time when it was very difficult and she was feeling very hurt and everything else. But generally, you know, we still remain very good friends, and I get on very well with the rest of her family and things like that. Even to the point where, you know, she and the kids and my partner at the time, we all moved overseas together. So it was, you know, the family of five chuffed off overseas for a few years. And my partner was here for about 6 months before he joined us. And he'd go over to my in-laws for dinner once every few weeks.
How nice. Yes. How chummy is that?
It was very, very chummy. It was very strange, but very chummy. No, it's good. But it's very, very nice. And I think it's a nice message to give to kids that when your parents split up for whatever reason, that, you know, you still can be friends and there doesn't have to be animosity about
the split. Well, what it does say is the old thing that gays often say in their relationships, that it's about family of choice, not about biological family. And it's actually an indication that family of choice is a very clear choice, and it actually does happen. And in fact, every family is a family of choice, even heterosexual families, because, you know, the couple choose each other. So it's just a nonsense.
This Joycast is a free service brought to you by Joy 94.9. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
Hi there, Joysters. You're on Is Nothing Sacred on Joy 94.9. It's now 27 minutes to 11. And we've been talking same-sex parenting with Michael Strauss from Technogaze and David Moore from Bent Notes and David's son, Matthew, and hearing stories about Michael's and my children at various stages during the night. And we last week, you might remember that we had a discussion about cycling and so on. And we're going to go back to that soon, but we... not straight away, and we'll just wrap up our bit of discussion about same-sex parenting.
It's been incredibly positive, these stories. I'm like, you guys are just a completely functional
That's what
family.
I was thinking.
I'm like, where's the break?
I wanted to ask everybody what the most difficult thing about being a gay,
oh, well, that's
an openly
funny.
Gay
I was
going to
ask what was positive, but I suppose that's silly, isn't it?
I've got lots of non-positive stories, but they're nothing related to being gay or not. It's just generally
about being a parent.
Yeah, and children being generally little shits. Sorry, Matthew, but, you know, it's
that's
true.
Your own fault.
It is my own fault.
Because, you know, don't you ever look at your children and think, oh, God, I used to say that to them, and they're saying it back to me now.
Well, I went through the opposite. It's like, you know, growing up, it's and your parents say something, you get sick and tired of hearing, I'll never say it to them, children. And then one day, you just think about it and you say, nah, I'm going to say it because it's so true.
You've turned into them.
Yes.
And it works. It works.
It does work.
But as you say, Jim, it's always a shock when you hear your children saying something back to you that you've said, and then you realise that your father said it to you.
Yes, I have experienced that myself, I have to say. So I actually don't think that we as gay parents are very much different to parents who are parents, whether they're the straight ones. We have the same issues. We have to pay the same pocket money. We have to do the same discipline.
I think it's also a generational or a time thing. I think being a gay parent 30 or 40 years ago is very, very different to being a gay parent today.
Like my mother was.
Right. Very much so then. And that, you know, generally acceptance today is much, much easier. So what was the story with your mother?
Well, when I came out as gay, and, you know, she said to me, what are you going to do about the children? And I said, I'm going to stay with them. And she said, well, you just remember your responsibilities because I had to. And then she wrote me a letter to tell me about, and we, as little children, we had this auntie and who used to be around our house all the time. And it turned out that this auntie was actually my mother's girlfriend.
Wow.
And the two husbands had discovered this, and so they'd given them the ultimatum that they could choose each other or they could choose their marriages, but they couldn't have the children if they chose each other. And so they both stayed in the marriage and they split up the relationship between the two women so that they could keep the kids. And I sort of think these days they would have told the men to piss off.
Oh, and these days they would have probably been able to. And they would have won
in the family court.
Exactly.
In those days they wouldn't have won. They wouldn't have had a hope.
Not at all.
Because there wasn't no-fault divorce in those days.
Yeah. So, you know,
so
from
it was
that point
a tragic situation, really, when you think about it.
Oh, it's very sad. Very, very sad. And it must have been very difficult for, you know, both your mother and her partner of the time to, you know, carry on in a heterosexual relationship when it just wasn't what they wanted.
It was weird when my mother died because we actually had to ring this woman up and say, guess what?
Mm.
She came to the funeral and she was all very nice and, you know, we included her in everything. But my brothers and sisters refused to acknowledge it. They said, oh, that's bullshit, you're just making it up. But
that's an interesting reaction.
Well, of course. And my sister at the time was a lesbian too.
Mm.
Runs in the family, clearly.
No, runs in my family. Rampant.
I'm not sure about my family.
It's cultural, no? In my opinion, though.
That's a whole other discussion.
No, we've had that discussion on this show. We've had the discussion about the gay gene, and we've discounted it. And we've got a podcast up about that if anybody wants to go to our podcast. Go to our Facebook page, people. Facebook.com/isnothingsacred on Joy 94.9. And go to the podcasts, and you'll find the podcast with Suzanne Waters talking about, is there a gay gene? And there isn't. We're not born this way. It is actually, as she says, she uses the Simone de Beauvoir philosophy of women are made, not created. And she says the same thing about gays and lesbians, made, not created.
So And essentially it wasn't important, is what she was saying.
She was saying it's a rights issue, and it doesn't matter whether you... The fact that you are gay is what gives you the rights. You have the rights as a human, not as do you have a gene that tells you whether you're one thing or the other.
I guess the importance of whether there is a gene or not is about as important as saying whether you've got blue eyes or green eyes.
It's exactly what her point is.
At the end of the day, what difference does it make?
Doesn't make any difference at all. So... That's an interesting take, really, on being a gay parent. Have you got any particular little funny stories you want to tell, David?
Yeah, when I came out, which was not all that long ago, I sat down and came out to my wife at the time, a year before I came out to the children. It happened to be Joy that forced me to come out to the children, as it happened, because when I got home from I think I was, what was I in here for? Taste of Radio or something like that. Matthew asked me a question. He said, Dad, what's DNA? And I said, well, deoxynucleic acid, whatever it is. You know what that is. And that was fine. And then my wife came to see me after after we'd eaten and said, you left your computer on. And I said, no, I didn't. I turned it off. But I had my own laptop and the home computer, and I'd left one of them on. And
you had it open to the DNA page.
Well, it actually wasn't open, but you know how one of the browsers has little images?
Yes.
And Matthew, being a much younger guy at the time,
He clicked on it,
and then he asked his sister, and she said, oh, I don't know. And so that sort of forced the issue. I needed to come out to them. But in coming out, that was fine. Spoke to Matthew and his sister. And then his older sister came home after being at calisthenics that night and went in and sat down and said, I'm gay. And she said, oh, I've known that for months, Dad.
How boring.
Anticlimax, yeah.
How fantastic.
I was stuck for words.
I think it was also the magazines that you left in your closet.
Oh, you found them, did you?
Oh, so your children were going through your closet in more ways than one.
It sounds like it, doesn't it?
Sorry, whose children haven't gone through anybody's drawers or closets? The way that I look at it is they will look once, they will go, ooh, and never look again. So that's fine.
Well, you know, it's like most people don't like to think of their parents having sex.
No, parents don't have sex.
So they... It doesn't come across, although my children had a morbid fascination with my sex life for a while, I have to say, but that's a story for another time, I suspect.
I had a very interesting experience where I actually walked in on my parents, which was a fun memory I've been trying to completely erase.
How old were you, Patrick?
I was about 11. Walked in and just went, oh, crap, that happened. And last fleeting glimpses of heterosexuality fell away from me. Then the angels were singing on high.
So that did it, did it?
Yep. No offence to my mother, but yep.
I remember my children walking in on me and they just said, what are you doing? And we just said, we're having a cuddle.
Aww.
And so that was, you know, it was acceptable. So go out of the room. Anyway, that's enough of that. And... thank you, Michael. Thank you, David.
Thank you, Jim.
And thank you, Matthew, for coming in.
No problem.
And next time we'll beat up all the rest of the children and tell them that they should have come in as well. Not that there was any room for them all, but anyway. And James, thank you for...
Joy 94.9 is a GLBTIQ community radio station in Melbourne, Australia. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
You're on Joy 94.9 on Is Nothing Sacred, and we've been talking same-sex parenting tonight, and so thanks, guys, who are in the studio for that. And we're going to continue the discussion we had last week about bicycles in Melbourne and in urban areas with Bojun Bjorkman, and we're going to go back to that interview which we played part of last week, and so here we go. And Steph's,
you know, people in cars are protected. They become socially weird. They say things to you that they wouldn't say to you standing at a bus stop with you. So I think it's a weird phenomenon. It's a psychological phenomenon that people get into their cars and they sort of become a little bit crazy and aggressive. I don't know if that's the only cause. I think there's also kind of... you know, when I am on my bike and I'm not wearing a helmet and I'm looking free and easy and calm and happy, because I do look happy on my bike, and I drive past a man in a V8 engine and I'm going faster than him because he's sitting in traffic, he gets super annoyed. So I think that's also part of it. Is a bicycle is the expression of liberty and freedom. And I think when you are the expression of something, other people are like, they're not really quite sure why it annoys the hell out of them, but it's really it annoys them because they don't quite have that yet. I have a friend in Copenhagen who says car drivers are just people who haven't discovered how to be happy yet. So So, look, I don't know the exact reason for that. I also get an incredible amount of aggression on the road. It's partly why I went, because I was also in the realm of why are people so weird about me simply minding my own business and getting around freely. But I do think that the advertising culture plays a very strong part in it. I think that cars are advertised as, and people take on the mentality, and you often talk to car drivers, is the roads are for us. And that isn't actually true. The history of roads is that they were created for bicycles, because if you think about the bicycle, it has a very narrow wheel and bumpy roads don't work. And so the people that actually petitioned for and started the smoothing of tarred roads was the Wheelman's, the American Wheelman's Association, which was a group of bicycle riders. So cars don't require smooth roads, but they've come to think that the road was invented for the car. It wasn't actually invented for the car. It was invented for the bicycle. So I think that's part of it as well. There's this kind of like, we paid for the roads. Actually, they don't. All people pay for roads. This is a weird thing. People think that car registration pays for roads. It doesn't. We all pay for roads in our taxes. Car registration was brought in to bankroll the massive road trauma that cars caused. You know, there was literally so many people being killed on the roads that governments were like, we can't pay for this. So they introduced car registration. So there's a lot of myths and misconceptions, and I think that contributes to this weird conversation that you're in a bike lane, you're minding your own business, you're having a great time, get off the road, bitch, you know, so, which is what I've had yelled at me. So
weirdly, I'm seeing a kind of parallel in a very, very odd way. I don't know why it's springing to my head, but when you were talking specifically about your friend in Copenhagen, talking about, you know, people who haven't learned to be happy, it kind of, and then we're talking like the differences between car people. Somehow I'm getting heterosexuals and homosexuals. Don't ask me why. I think it's generally just because it's considered the norm, maybe. Maybe that's it.
I think that would be part of it.
That's the way I'm sort of interpreting it for listeners especially, yeah. Is the fact that obviously a lot of people drive cars. I don't. I have a license, but personally I find cars the most frightening thing in the world. But I also don't own a bike, but that's simply because I haven't saved up enough money. But
well, I think people are afraid of change and about giving up what they perceive to be their rights, which I think, yeah, comes back to that same thing about not wanting to share, finding something new. Because I even noticed riding my bike around where I live in Brunswick compared to where my parents live in the southern suburbs, like the cars just don't know what to do. They kind of freak out and they like hover behind you, whereas Brunswick drivers are kind of more used to it. It seems like less of an issue, I guess.
Yeah, I think it's definitely the case. You know, bicycling is one of the things we say, people in the sort of the thinking about this issue, they say we want to normalize bicycle use. And Copenhagen and Amsterdam have done that. Mm. It's just like completely and utterly normal that you would get on your bicycle. So I think it is that's a component. I think it's multiple components. But there is also the element, and sorry, I diverged. And there was also the element of, you know, the advertising culture around, you know, cars are it, and there's a real status symbol. And one of the things that I discovered, South America and Africa really, really demonstrate this quite palpably. It's less sort of obvious in European nations, but in countries that have experienced great poverty, the car represents wealth.
Yeah, okay.
And so it's not really about the car anymore. It's about, I don't want to be seen as the poor man. And in countries in South America, it's so strong. That mentality is so strong that it's really heartbreaking, because you get a nation like Argentina, where only 15% of the population actually has a car. So the rest, you know, hang out of trains and overcrowded trains. I filmed one and I literally couldn't believe my eyes. There were people hanging out of that train, and I said to someone, don't half of those people die? Like, do they accidentally? Yeah, they said, yeah, a lot of them, they just slip and die. And you know, like, and I said, well, why aren't they riding a bicycle into town? And they said, well, it's a status thing. You know, you're a poor man if you have a bicycle. Clearly, you can't afford anything else. So the bicycle has become this weird representation of poverty.
Mm.
When actually for me, I am wealthier because I don't have a car. You know, that I used to have a car many years ago. It's very embarrassing to admit that, but I did. I tell you what, when I sold my car, I suddenly had $15,000 extra every year. You know, and people say to me, how do you spend 2 years traveling the world? And I'm like, well, I don't bankroll a car. I have an exorbitant amount of spare cash, you know.
To find out more about Joy 94.9, check out joy.org.au.
It's interesting that that status and wealth thing, given the, I guess, stereotypes around cyclists in Melbourne being the hipster, you know, uni student types and the wealthy Brighton, you know,
I suppose
middle-aged men in their lycra.
I suppose we're relatively lucky, though, as being a first world nation, and we haven't
Have that stigma.
Yeah, we don't have that stigma, and we don't also have, you were saying, Argentina, 15% own a car. So we're guessing that in that case, we're looking at 85% who are not able to afford a car.
Yeah.
Whereas in Australia, most of the adult population have the ability, maybe not to bankroll an expensive car, but at least to have the ability to own one.
Yeah, exactly.
And so, therefore, it's kind of a reversal where it becomes a luxury.
Yeah.
I would like to ask a little bit more about, just quickly, because we are running a little bit out of time, actually, just about when you were talking about the politicians specifically, or just people in the bicycling community. I love how that's a thing. In Amsterdam and Copenhagen, where they're talking about normalising it. So what incentives have they been bringing in, other than like the sheer fact that they just have to, because there's not any more space, there are too many cars. How did they then achieve this goal? What did they do to equal that? And what do you think Melbourne, if Melbourne wants to go along this route, because undoubtedly, we will have to if this is going to be the case. What can they do to change their perspective?
So the Netherlands were lucky. They never allowed car culture to take hold. They really, you know, in the 1950s, 60s and 70s, they had a beautiful city, and it started to get destroyed by road building, unchecked road building. And the people of Amsterdam said, hang on a second, this is not what we want. We love our beautiful city and we want to keep our city beautiful. So they never had that real problem of trying to restore the balance. So that's the first part. You know, Melbourne's up against, we kind of lost that a long time ago. So it's really just always been normal in Amsterdam, and so it's very easy for them to maintain that. However, in saying that, they have to work hard at it. I promise you, they get a lot of immigrants from the rest of Europe who don't have bicycle culture, and those they've found with the immigrants that they don't naturally take up bicycle use. Mm. Right? They didn't do it as a child. They're afraid of doing it. They don't know how to ride bicycles. It's not normal for them. So it really is a case of, if it's normal for you and it's habitual, you'll do it. So I guess what we want to say is not we want to normalize it, we want to habituate it. You know, it just becomes something that one does in one's life, and we start that at a very small age, you know, and that's what they do in Amsterdam. Same with Copenhagen. They never lost their bicycle culture, but they do have to work very hard at maintaining it. So they do a lot of initiatives. You know, they have incentives for people to ride to work. People who ride to work get paid extra, get bonuses, this, that, the next thing. There's multiple schemes. I can't remember them all. The city of Copenhagen obviously has it in its charter. So it does an incredible amount of work. It has constantly increasing the size of bike lanes, you know, constantly giving more space to bicycles. And they've found every single time they increase the bicycle lane by I can't remember the exact figure, but it's something like every single time they double a bicycle lane, they get 20% more bikes. So they're just Amsterdam and Copenhagen are really just in the realm of, let's just make it easy.
Thank you for listening to a Joycast from Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.